Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Ernesto Tagworker, founder at fastruby.io and open source maintainer. Ernesto, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. It's great to be back. And yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about code quality with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. And indeed, we're going to talk about code quality. Code quality is something I think about a lot and write about a lot and just obviously deal with on a day-to-day basis as a programmer. And so how should we come at this? Well, first of all, I know that you, you've been like maintaining some gems around code quality. So maybe we can start by that, start by talking about those. And with that, maybe we can talk about what is code quality. So let me ask you that. What, when you hear the term code quality, what does that make you think of?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a great question right there. What is code quality? I think like it's when I think about it, like the pragmatic approach to it is like, okay, I look at this quote, I look at this particular code and I can change it, and changing it is easy. You know, like I can go in, make the change that I had to make, run the tests, and everything works. So I guess in a way, if I look at a change that I need to implement in a code base, I think, oh, okay, this change is probably going to take me a day, you know, because we are optimistic. We assume everything's going to be fine.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, but then I go in and it actually takes me a week to do it. Then it's like, well, okay, maybe there's no, like the quality that I thought was going to be there is not there. So instead of taking me a day to implement this small change, it took me a week because the quality of the code is not up to par.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly how I would express it too. And this is one of those things that's maybe easier to define in the negative than in the positive. So like, what's the characteristic of code that is low quality? I would say code that is expensive and or risky to change, that's code that's low quality. And so high quality code is code that it's inexpensive and low risk to change. And you could maybe even just combine those two and say inexpensive to change or easy to change, because it's almost all the same stuff. Because if it's hard to change, that's just kind of another way of saying it's going to be time consuming to change, which is another way to say it's going to be expensive to change. And if it's risky to change, that's kind of just another way to say that it's going to be expensive to change too, because risk means something's going to go wrong, which means you're going to have some kind of business problem as a result of it. Even if that business problem is just spending a little more time on coding, that's going to cost more money. So that's how, that's how I think of it.
Well, I think, you know, there are books written about this very topic. Like in one of my last talks, I talked a little bit about the tar pit and like basically getting entangled in the tar pit when you're trying to make like one small change.
Wait, what's the tar pit?
Okay, so Fred Brooks many, many years ago wrote a book called The Mythical Man Month. I highly recommend it. It's a little outdated with some terms, but a lot of the basic concepts still apply. And it's like the tar pit is like us trying to solve problems and like basically taking, I think about it this way, like taking forever to ship things because we get entangled in the tar pit, and then because the code base or the systems or like the teams were not working properly. So when I gave this talk, it was called Escaping the Tar Pit. You can probably find it on YouTube. I talked a little bit about like, yeah, what is quality? Like quality like has a lot of perspectives. Like the end user sees a part of code quality and it's like, does the thing do what I think it's going to do? It's like, yes, it does. Oh, cool. The code has quality to the end user. But then to us, like we're looking at it and we're thinking, okay, if I had to maintain this piece of code today, does it have code quality? And then it's like, well, does it have tests? Do the tests test the right things? Is the architecture the right way? If it's a Rails application, it's like, does it actually follow the conventions? You know, model view controller and all that, and fat model scanning controller and all that. So yeah, there are even ISO models that talk about quality, and they talk about like portability and maintainability and performance and all that. So I guess when we started talking about code quality, we're talking about maintainability. And I think that's the one thing that I care about when I look at a piece of code and I say, does it have code quality? Yes. Yes, it does, because it's doing what it's supposed to do and it's easy to maintain.
Yeah. I had a thought and I completely just lost it. Let's move on to your gems. What are these gems that you've started maintaining recently?
One thing I recently noticed is that a lot of the code quality gems out there are a little bit abandoned in the Ruby community. So like metric foo is one of them. When I first saw it like 10 years ago, I thought, oh, this is awesome. It runs a bunch of tools against your code base and it tells you, you know, what's the code quality or what is an aspect of the code quality of every single file in your project. But metric foo had been abandoned for a couple of years. And my team started looking into it and we reached out to the past maintainer and we're like, hey, do you need help maintaining this? And he was like, yeah. So we started maintaining metric foo. Same thing happened to Rails stats. Rails stats is a Ruby gem that's kind of like a drop-in replacement to the native Rails rake stats. So we also reached out to the maintainer and we're like, okay, this would be really cool to maintain and to add more value to it. And he was like, yeah, sure, start maintaining it. So we've been contributing to those projects. And I think in the past, I've talked a little bit about Skunk, which is another tool that assesses code quality in a way that it combines churn, complexity, and code coverage to give you a Skunk score of every single file in your application. Now, Skunk relies on RubyCritic, and RubyCritic, it has not been abandoned. There's been like a lot of progress with RubyCritic, but considering Skunk relied so much on RubyCritic, I reached out to the maintainer, and I started contributing to that project, so I've been actively working on those gems right now. And, you know, they're like the open source alternative to using CodeClimate or, you know, like Code Scene or Sonar Cube. But yeah, those are a few gems that I've started maintaining recently. And it's funny that it feels like a lot of people start maintaining them, contributing to them, and then at some point they just stop working on it, and not really sure why.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that open source maintaining can be an unrewarding job.
Yeah, that's true. Usually you only hear from people when things don't work or there's a bug.
Yeah, and obviously, like most people, I don't know about most people, probably most people are not getting paid to work on these things, and so you have to squeeze in that time to work on it and stuff like that. So I have to admit that I don't use any kind of code quality tools or anything like that, except we do use RuboCop, which just catches, like, you know, syntax issues, like you didn't use the parentheses in the right place and really minor superficial stuff like that. Cause like we are small enough, it's myself and two other developers, that like we can just use like me as the benevolent dictator of the application to review all the PRs and just like, keep the code quality at a reasonable level through that method. So as somebody who doesn't really use these tools, I'm curious about something. And by the way, this isn't like a conscious choice of mine not to use these tools. It's just like sheer ignorance. So my question is, I doubt that these tools are like zero helpfulness. Like I'm sure they help some, but I also am sure that the tools, like, it's not as if you can install these gems and start running them on every commit or PR and like all of a sudden your code is just amazing just because you're using these tools. Obviously it's somewhere in between. So can you talk about your perception of like the specific value of these tools and the gaps these tools leave behind where you have to use human discretion in those areas just because no tool could provide what you need in those areas?
Sure. Yeah. I think, in a way RuboCop saves you time reviewing pull requests, right? Because you define like, okay, this is the style guide that we're going to use. So then when you have to review a pull request, maybe you installed Git hooks or, you know, like some sort of tool that automatically tells the submitter, hey, you know, like these things that you're submitting do not comply with our style guide. So fix them or add them to a to-do file. Just like RuboCop, Reek is another tool that can be useful for detecting code smells. So if you don't want to take the time to review the pull request and be like, oh, hey, this is a code smell because, and then you have to look up the definition and you have to educate the developer as in why it is a code smell. Well, Reek could do that for you automatically, you know, and sure, it comes with a set of default code smells. You might not agree with all of them, and that's fine. But the nice thing about these tools like RuboCop, Reek, and all that is that you can configure them to define your code quality standard. Let's say, like, the code needs to follow this style. We don't want these smells in the code. We want classes that are, I don't know, like smaller than 200 lines of code. I think the awesome thing about these tools is that they will save you time. Sure, when you adopt them for the first time, it's going to take you time to mold it to, you know, live up to your standards. But then once it's in place, you don't have to have those conversations anymore. You can focus on deeper, maybe higher level conversations when you're reviewing a pull request.
Yeah, one of the reasons I like using tools like RuboCop is because it eliminates like arbitrary decision making regarding style. I worked at this place one time where like we would have all these arguments about how to format our code, and it was just such a waste of time because most of it's just like personal opinion and nobody could say who was right and who was wrong. And like the RuboCop defaults are like, I really don't agree with them, like not even close. And so we use this, I think it's from Justin Searles, it's called Standard. I don't know, because I wasn't the one who set it all up. I don't know exactly how that connects to RuboCop, but we dropped in standard, however that works. And that's been great because we just like use standard, and standard is like more reasonable than the RuboCop defaults, I find. And even though we don't all agree with every single detail in there, we do agree that we're just going to use this thing and not like arbitrarily add or take away rules and stuff like, because that's a slippery slope. Once you start like arbitrarily adding or taking away rules, it's like, well, where do you draw the line and who gets to decide and all that stuff?
Yeah, we love standard as well. We have like a Rails template that we use for every new Rails project in the company. And standard is one of the dependencies that we add there. Yeah, I mean, it is a slippery slope. But I love that there are tools out there that simplify this for us. You know, like another thing that you probably have as a rule is that, well, if you're adding a feature, you need to add tests, right? Well, you could use something like SimpleCov and something like CodeCov. CodeCov is the service, SimpleCov is the tool, right? But CodeCov could automatically comment in your pull request and say, hey, you're submitting a pull request that's adding like 100 lines of code for this new feature, which is decreasing your code coverage percentage because you didn't add any tests. So instead of like, sometimes it can be awkward, you know, to be like, hey, can you add like a test for this? Because like that's what every pull request should have. You can have CodeCov have that awkward conversation and be like, hey, you're dropping code coverage when you add this pull request. So can you not do that?
Yeah, that's actually another benefit of tools like this is like, it is taxing to have to be either on the receiving end or the giving end of those little nitpicky criticisms like that. There's this concept that I use sometimes. It's the concept of the emotional bank account. And like, if you like wrong somebody in some way or accidentally insult someone or intentionally insult someone or something like that, that makes like a withdrawal from their emotional bank account. And you have to make deposits by, you know, I don't know, doing something nice for them or giving them a compliment or something like that, so you don't completely drain that emotional bank account and then emotionally overdraft, which sounds funny to say in that analogy, but it actually really fits, because if you reach that point, then you have like an event where like people get really, they just reach the breaking point or whatever. And I think all that like kind of mushy-gushy emotional stuff, even though we're working with technical stuff, it totally applies. And so like I try to be conscious of that in all my PR reviews, like trying to balance positive feedback with the negative feedback. And if you're having to say stuff like, hey, you have a trailing space on this line, can you like remove this trailing space? Then that's a waste of your like emotional bank account budget. You have to make a tiny little withdrawal from that emotional bank account. And I think if you have a tool that automates that stuff, then it no longer applies because they're no longer having a person make that withdrawal. It's just a tool doing the tool's job.
Yeah. And I love that analogy. You know, you and I are both parents, right? So in a way, if you've been building a product, you know, for the past few years, it's your baby, you know, and nobody likes it when someone comes in and calls your baby ugly, you know. So you need to think about that. At fastruby.io, we focus on Ruby on Rails upgrades, right? But before we take on any projects, we do a code audit. So clients pay us $3,000 to get an action plan and to get a code audit for the Rails application. So in a way, we have to be very careful about what we tell them. And in order to fix that, or in order to get away with criticizing their application, we use a lot of automated tools. You know, we use RubyCritic, we use Skunk. Sometimes in the past, we used to use CodeClimate. And all these automated tools are basically based on known standards or known ideas. So one of the items in the code audit is like showing the client that they have a certain amount of files that are super complex and have very little code coverage. And that's where Skunk comes in. Like, I built that tool because I needed to see the files that were the most complex files and had like very little tests, because as we go, you know, making progress with the Rails upgrade project, usually those files are the ones that are going to be a problem for us.
If we can just take a quick little detour, I'm super curious if there are like issues that you tend to see commonly in Rails projects that you'd perform these code audits on, like, for example, really long model files, that kind of stuff. What do you see over and over?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, even though we have a bunch of tools and, you know, part of the process is automated, like, there needs to be like a qualitative assessment of the Rails application, because, you know, like, maybe Skunk reports, hey, it's all good, but then the developer didn't follow the conventions. They have a bunch of queries inside their templates. They have huge controllers and skinny models, or, you know, something that gets doesn't follow the Rails way. So part of the work that we do needs to be also like, okay, we need to have like two humans looking at your source code and trying to figure out like what's funny, or what's that one thing that's stopping them from upgrading themselves. You know, clients that come to us, it's, you know, they come to us because they tried to upgrade by themselves and it wasn't easy. So they're like, oh shoot, this is going to take weeks or months of work, and we can't really take our developers off our roadmap. So that's when we come in and we're like, okay, sure, we'll upgrade it. And at the end of the day, you're going to end up running Rails 6.1 and nothing is going to break. So in a way, we're kind of like open source maintainers in a way. We need to like go in, do our job, and the only way the client is going to be happy is that if we don't break anything and if we take them to the latest version of Rails. So that's actually like a funny thing. Like, if we did everything right, they had no down times and they're running the latest version of Rails.
Yeah. Yeah. That must be a pretty nice feeling when people get to that finish line and you're just on the latest version of Rails and you're just good. It's always like, I don't know, like the feeling of like, you spend a bunch of time cleaning your house and then you step back and it's all clean. And it's just this great feeling of like everything's done.
Yeah. And I think Rails, in a way, the one thing I loved when I started working on it is like convention over configuration. So one of the common mistakes that we see is like the developers maybe came from PHP or Java and they had a way of doing things, and they just didn't change their way of doing things, and they just did the thing as if it was Java or PHP code. And then it's like, okay, you broke the conventions, and that's going to be a problem for us as we go about the upgrade. But the biggest blocker, I would say, is like teams don't write enough tests. And I think I talked to you about this idea that I wish there was someone out there that magically upgraded or increased the code coverage for Rails projects. And I wish there was like a market there and an agency.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, because like, I don't do consulting anymore, but if I did, like, that would be an interesting idea for me, because I like am kind of known as the Rails testing guy. But what I don't know is the extent to which people like want that. You know, like, do organizations want somebody to come in and like try to help them increase their code coverage? You know, theoretically, everybody wants that, obviously. But in practice, do businesses actually spend money and seek out consultants to write tests for them and all that stuff? Is that a real thing that happens? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think the smart technical leader actually hires someone like you to coach teams into learning these practices and kind of like adopting them and having everybody be like a good Boy Scout, and basically, you know, in include or adopt this new practice that is like, okay, you know, every time you write a feature, every time you fix a bug, you add a test to verify that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. And that way, gradually, you start increasing code coverage. So yeah, I think that's a very good point. I see a lot of technical leaders actually hire consultants to help them increase code coverage, but more like to coach their developers into becoming better TDD practitioners or, you know, test writers.
Yeah, yeah, because the root cause of the problem, it's not like you're just missing some tests and you can just add some tests and that's that. The reason that you don't have a lot of tests is because you're not writing tests, and the reason for that might be that you don't have the skills present on the team in order to do that. And that's like not something that can just be fixed. Like, I've seen people try to implement the rule of all new code must have tests from now on, but that doesn't work if you don't have the skills on the team or like the technical infrastructure on the product to support that. And also like the areas of the code that are like most in need of testing, the like most critical areas, are often the areas that are most difficult to write tests for. So you could make like a one line change, but if it's to a sufficiently complex area, writing a test for that one line change could take like 3 days, even though the change itself only took 5 minutes. So that's definitely not an easy thing.
Yeah, I think that's actually an interesting idea. Like code coverage is a metric that we care about a lot, but sometimes we get clients that want to work with us and they have like 30% code coverage. And we decide not to take those clients usually because we rely heavily on tests. Like, we don't want to be like disrupting your team, asking your team like, hey, is this working the way it's supposed to? No, we just want to run the test suite with the next version of Rails, check that everything works, and then, you know, continue making progress. So, but the one thing about code coverage and that particular metric, like 30%, it's like it doesn't really tell you whether it's testing the critical user flow, like the most critical user flow, or just like some silly use cases. So I think in that sense, we also need to talk to our clients when before taking in a Rails upgrade project and being like, hey, you know, like 30% of your code is covered by a test suite. We need you to tell us like what's your critical user flow and tell us whether that is covered by tests or not. Because sometimes, you know, as we deploy changes to production, maybe we missed a case and then the client starts losing money. So we never want that to happen. And in a way, code coverage metrics are can sometimes lie to you, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because code coverage is a question that I get with some frequency. And people ask me, like, how should I think about code coverage? And my answer is that I don't think you should actually pay attention to your code coverage number. Like, I don't think it's bad to be, I don't think it's bad to measure it. Obviously, it's better to know that number than to just be ignorant. But I think the signals that people should go off of are different signals. Like, what kinds of problems am I having as a result of not having enough tests? Because there's certain problems that you'll have, like you can't get a deployment out, you're doing a lot of manual testing, you're experiencing a lot of bugs, those kinds of things. And like, if you have those problems, you know, because obviously you're not writing tests just to check a box so you can have a test, like there's an actual practical purpose to having them. And so I say, this is a case where you should actually go with your emotions in your gut. Does it feel like you're having too many problems with bugs and infrequent deployments and all that kind of stuff? If not, then there's probably no problem. But for most organizations, they do have more of those problems than they would like to have. And so I say, listen to those pains. And if it hurts, then add more tests. And if it doesn't hurt, then you're good. But it's almost like you can just say a priori of any organization, you probably need more tests. There's very few code bases where you look at them and you're like, oh, hey, there's just tests for everything. At least that's been my experience. How about you?
Yeah, I think in terms of like code coverage and test suites, we see like we get a bunch of leads every week that of people who want to upgrade their Rails application. And I would say maybe 40% of those leads have a solid test suite, meaning 60% or more in terms of code coverage. Now, yeah, that number is not like it's not a magical number, but it is a signal. You know, it's telling you like, okay, this team cares about your tests and they're probably writing tests for every pull request. When there is like a client that has like 20% or no test suite at all, it's like, okay, this particular team does not value tests, doesn't write them, doesn't maintain them. And I really like your idea of what you said, like of the signals, like the other signals, like what are the non-technical signals? And usually that can be explained like with a sentence by like the product owner or the CEO or the founder, or maybe like the end users is like, well, oh, this is very slow, or like this, you know, there's so many bugs here, or like, oh, why does the development team take so long to change this button over here? Why are they taking so long to do X, Y, or Z? And, you know, like maybe like non-technical people might think like, oh, these developers are lazy, you know, what's going on? But no, at the end of the day, it's like, no, the code base is probably a mess. They're probably under pressure to ship things. They're probably under pressure to get things into production. They're told that tests do not value. So then it's kind of like a catch-22. It's like a culture problem where developers are asked to ship things without tests. They do that, and then that ends up biting them later on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. I had an opportunity recently to kind of pat myself on the back, because developers do get pressure not to write tests sometimes, because the perception is that writing tests adds time, but the reality is that writing tests is a time saver, because the testing has to happen one way or the other. Like, you either have to do it via automated tests, or the developer can manually test it, or your boss or project manager will manually test it, or a QA person, or worst of all, the end user will be the person testing all the features. And I've experienced all of those scenarios. And the least expensive one by far is to have automated tests. And so the idea that you can save time by skipping tests is just nonsensical. And luckily, so my boss recently brought up the idea that maybe we could save time by maybe judiciously writing fewer tests in certain scenarios. And I kind of explained to him what I explained just now, and he got it because he's like a smart guy. So that's great. But I think I wish that more developers would like not succumb to that pressure of not writing tests and cutting corners and stuff like that, because ultimately it's you who has to live with the consequences of bowing to that pressure.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, you are a senior technical person and you're not afraid to push back at this point because you're the leader in your team. And at the end of the day, the non-technical person comes to you and it's like, hey, do you think this is a good idea or not? And you're like, no, this is not a good idea because of this few things. So again, I think like it's a matter of communicating with non-technical people and explaining that, yeah, not writing tests is going to get your code into production faster, but the team is going to have less confidence. There might be more bugs because you're relying on humans testing your code. Like you said, like a QA person, a product manager, at the end of the day, maybe a production user. But yeah, I think like one thing that we as technical leaders need to work on is our communication skills to translate like these technical terms into non-technical terms. Like, yes, you will get code into production faster, but you might end up with regressions. At the end of the day, the team is going to have less confidence on their code because there's no testing that everything works. And then, you know, in the long term, you're probably going to end up with a team that's more like fixing bugs, putting out fires, slowing down the product roadmap because they're fixing things that were not tested properly.
And something you said was an interesting point. Like, I have been coding forever at this point, and I'm very comfortable pushing back when I receive pressure to do things a certain way that I don't agree with. But for somebody who's maybe more earlier in their career, if they get pressure to skip tests, they might not feel like they have the clout yet to push back, or they might not be able to articulate the reasons why that wouldn't be a good idea.
So even if you're not a junior, like I used to freelance before I started Fast Ruby and Bamboo Labs. We're now a team of 12 and I'm the CTO there. So like at this point, I'm okay pushing back. But back in the days when I was a freelance developer, I was senior. I sold this client on my skills. I'm starting to work on this project. And then, you know, yeah, maybe like the team, my client's team is like, oh, no, don't write tests. Just ship the code. And maybe like the first month, I don't want to be like, I'm not going to do that. Maybe I just need the money to feed my kids and stuff, you know?
Right.
So it depends on a lot of things. Maybe once you're comfortable with your client, you can start to push back a little and be like, no, look, like this is like the best way to do it. And you start to explain your reasons. And unfortunately, as a freelance developer, you're going to run into clients that expect you to be a code monkey. You know, they expect you to look at the story, write the code, and just ship it. Like, I don't want tests. I just want code running in production, and you're here to write code. So you're going to run into those people, and you can try to change them. But if that doesn't work, I recommend you find another client or you find another company that values tests and agile methodologies and doesn't see you as a code monkey.
Yeah, that's very well put. One of the things that maybe comes with being a senior level developer and experienced freelancer and stuff like that, just like you said, is like the skill of finding good people to work for. Because I've certainly worked, you know, if you work for somebody who just has a really bad attitude about that stuff, there's no fixing it. If you have somebody who's like smart but not very educated in the ways of software yet, like my boss, he's a doctor, and he's a super smart guy, but his background is not in software, his background's in medicine. And so there have been occasions where I've had to educate him regarding software, but when I explain the logic of it to him, he says, oh, okay, like I thought of it this way before, but now that you explain all that, it makes sense, so now I think of it this way. And that's great, and I can work with that. What you can't work with somebody who is just like, for lack of a nicer way to put it, somebody who's just dumb and like has this attitude of just ship code, don't write tests. I don't care about the quality. I just care that it works, because it's like a self-deception that you can go faster if you cut corners. You'll ultimately end up going slower.
Yeah, I agree. And you want to work with smart clients and smart leaders who don't just see like, okay, features being deployed, but also like, like features that don't break getting deployed, and like your defect ratio being like very low. I think like it's hard. I think the hard part or the challenge is to communicate properly with these non-technical people. to explain like that you know better because you see the code and you see what happens when you don't write tests. So you need them to trust you.
All right. So Ernesto, I want to close out the episode by asking you for some personal advice. On my project at work, like I said, we don't have any code quality tools other than RuboCop. For somebody like me who's in that situation, what would you recommend in terms of tooling that I put on my project so I can start looking at these code quality metrics?
Well, I'm going to be a little selfish here and say that you need to use Skunk because Skunk will give you an idea of where like the most complex files are and the ones that are least covered by tests. And I know how much you care about tests because you're the testing guy. So if you want to get a snapshot of your code base and see, okay, these are like the top three files that are super complex and have little tests, then they're going to have a super, super high Skunk score. And that can guide you in your technical debt journey, right? Like the best teams that I work with are the teams that dedicate some time and every sprint to pay off some technical debt. So if you want to be smart about it and be data driven, then you want to find those files that are the stinkiest and maybe prioritize those in the next, technical debt activities that you do.
Okay.
Another one, I'll give you another one. I'll say Reek is also great as well. You might find it a little bit annoying at first because you might be like, oh, that's not a code smell, and yada, yada. But you can configure it to ignore the one rule or the few rules that you don't like. I've actually found myself learning through the process of writing code and applying Reek and seeing like the Reek reports. And sure, some of the rules are a little annoying, so I've definitely disabled some. But they're definitely like a good way to avoid code smells and reduce the back and forth in your pull requests. So Reek and Skunk are my recommendations for you.
Okay. Well, I took note of both those. And of course, we'll put all this stuff in the show notes. Any other links or anything like that that you want to leave people with before we wrap up?
No, if anybody is interested in some of the content we write a lot about Rails and Rails upgrade guides and Rails upgrade tips. They can go to fastruby.io/blog and read some of our articles there. Or they can just follow me on Twitter, etacworker, and I usually tweet about code and politics, so they might be interested in that.
Well, Ernesto, thanks so much for coming on the show.
All right, thanks, Jason.